I'm going to be completely honest with you. Many of the memories I have from that night are very vague. It seems crazy that I would forget something like that, but I am aware that my brain is probably trying to repress what I experienced that night. It was about 11 p.m. and I was driving down the highway, going to join my family on our annual road trip. I should have joined them much earlier, but I had a lot of work to finish at the office before I could finish my vacation. After many hours without taking a break, I was able to leave and was ready to join my family. The first part of the road consisted of a huge highway full of cars, illuminated only by the headlights of my car and the sporadic lights of the posts along the road. The speed kept me alert, exceeding 60 miles per hour. It was a fast highway, and it was the shortest part of the road. I was driving casually when, suddenly, I noticed something strange on my right. A car was moving at the same speed as mine. At first, I didn't pay much attention to it, but something about the way it was moving caught my interest. I looked out of the corner of my eye and saw it. A woman sitting in the back of the car, on the outside, not holding on. She didn't seem to be struggling to hold on, just sitting there, unmoving, despite the speed. My eyes grew wide and my heart began to pound. How could that be possible? I tried to focus on the road, thinking that maybe I was hallucinating due to fatigue, or maybe it was a mannequin or some prankster. But when I looked again, there she was, in a short green dress, her face pale and her eyes looking nowhere. We came to a red light and both cars stopped. The scene became even more surreal. The woman started banging on the car door, trying to get in, but to no avail. Her desperate look and frantic pounding made my hair stand on end. But you know what the weirdest thing was? No one seemed to notice. Inside the car, no one seemed to react to it. Among the cars that had gotten off the highway, no one was looking at her, which was even weirder. The whole situation made me very uncomfortable. I didn't want to stay there a second longer, so when the light changed to green, I accelerated with all of my strength. As I drove down the highway, I couldn't get what I had just seen out of my head. I tried to rationalize it. Maybe it was a bad joke, or just my mind playing tricks on me. None of those explanations made sense, so I came to the conclusion that it was simply a situation I didn't understand, which could happen. But then, while my thoughts were trying to find a logical explanation, I felt a presence in my car. A chill ran down my spine, and my hands began to tremble on the steering wheel. I looked in the rearview mirror, and there she was, sitting in the back of my car, exactly as I had seen her in the other car. She wasn't moving, she wasn't talking, just looking back, sitting casually. My breathing became erratic, and panic began to take over. How had she gotten in? I stopped the car abruptly on the shoulder and turned to face her, but there was no sign of the woman. I dropped back against the back of the seat, trying to catch my breath and calm my nerves. I still wasn't going to jump to any hasty conclusions. Surely this was accumulated fatigue or fever. I had been working too hard and was too nervous about getting out of there as soon as possible. Maybe the stress had played a trick on me. I tried to relax and keep driving. The last thing I needed was an accident because I wasn't fit to drive. I took a few minutes to calm down before getting back in the car. I started the engine again and began to drive, but this time I couldn't stop looking in the rearview mirror, hoping to see something. Seeing nothing in the mirror calmed me down, but it also filled me with anxiety. I felt that sooner or later I would see something behind me, and that terrified me. I drove for several miles without incident, but the tension in my chest increased with every mile I drove. Suddenly, I heard a loud bang, as if someone had fallen on the roof of the car. I quickly looked around, but saw nothing out of the ordinary. To my surprise and horror, the woman was in the back seat, staring at me. I wanted to stop the car, but I could not. It was as if my body was paralyzed, only it wasn't. My hands and feet kept moving as if I was ordering them to drive normally. Something was forcing me to keep driving. My eyes froze on the road and I couldn't turn my head. I began to feel someone's breathing right behind me, but I couldn't turn around to see. I didn't know what was going on behind me, but the woman was slowly approaching. Suddenly, I saw a car driving straight towards me. The car was getting closer and closer. We were going to crash. I regain control of my body at the last moment and dodge the car, barely avoiding a head-on collision. I looked back immediately, but the woman was gone. After that nightmare, I stopped my car immediately and got out shaking. I needed a moment to process what had just happened. Every time I thought the nightmare was over, she would reappear. Why was she following me? What did she want from me? I went back to my car, hoping that this was the last time I would see her. I started the engine and drove off, trying to stay calm. But the paranoia wouldn't leave me alone. I drove at high speed, with only a few kilometers to go before I was off the road and could leave the car. The tension was mounting, and my nerves were on edge. Finally, the road became darker. Was it my imagination, or was it always difficult to see the road? Suddenly, without warning, the woman appeared in the middle of the road. I tried to brake, but the brakes didn't respond in time. The car skidded and skidded off the road, crashing violently into a tree. The impact left me stunned, with the air full of dust and the sound of twisted metal. I felt trapped in the car, but when I looked up, she was there. The woman was on the road, slowly approaching me. Her body no longer looked human, moving like a spider, her limbs bending at impossible angles, her eyes fixed on mine. I tried to free myself from the seatbelt, but it was stuck. I watched her come closer and closer, her face expressionless, her eyes empty. I knew I had no escape. She was trembling nervously with anticipation. I didn't know what that thing was, but I was sure it was going to hurt me if I didn't escape. My mind panicked, desperately searching for a way to free myself. I felt the coldness of the metal against my skin as I struggled with the seatbelt. The woman was so close I could see every detail of her pale, lifeless face. Every time I blinked, she seemed a little closer. Suddenly, the sound of an approaching car brought me out of my despair. The lights of another vehicle illuminated my crashed car, and the woman stopped dead in her tracks. She turned her head slowly towards the lights and, in an instant, sped away, disappearing into the darkness. The driver of the other car, an older man, ran towards me and helped me out of the car. I was in shock, shaking, unable to speak. He took me to safety and called an ambulance. As we waited, I thought about telling him what I had seen, but decided to keep quiet. The man had saved my life. I didn't want him to think he had saved a psychopath. The ambulance arrived and the paramedics attended to me. My injuries were superficial. I was lucky that something worse hadn't happened to me. The man gave me his phone number to tell him if I had been cured, and a few days later, I texted him to tell him that everything was fine. Within minutes of writing to him, I received the news. The man who had helped me on the road had died in strange circumstances. The man was found dismembered in his car. The police don't understand how he died that way. It was as if a wild animal had devoured him while he was driving. The man never took his hands off the wheel while it was happening. When I called the police posing as a relative of the man, a somewhat morbid and deranged police officer not only told me these details, but that the man must have died a horrible and surely slow, painful death. When I say the word an unsinkable ship, I know most of you think about the RMS Titanic. And we all know how that story ended. Today, I am about to tell you the story of another unsinkable ship. That sank or perhaps disappeared? Keep watching to find out. Back in 1967, my father was working as a Coast Guard in Miami. And even all those years ago, Miami's Christmas lights were a tourist attraction. So every year around Christmas and New Year, people from all over the states and sometimes even foreigners visit Miami to see the lights. Although it was a challenging job, my father enjoyed every minute of it. He and his team members were some of the best Coast Guards in Miami. Another thing had become very popular at that time, especially amongst the Army, cargo ships, and sailors, was the disappearing of ships and aircraft in the Bermuda Triangle. Although it was a hot topic, my dad had never firsthand experienced the investigation of a missing ship. But it all changed on the night of December 22, 1967, when they received a distress call. Dan Burrick and Father Patrick Horgan were two of the male tourists who had come down to Miami to see the Christmas lights in the year 1967. Their plan was simple. They were going to board the unsinkable ship and tour the coast of Miami in their luxury cruise. And they did exactly that. On the night of December 22, 1967, the two gentlemen left the yacht marina in Burrick's 23-foot cabin cruiser named Witchcraft to enjoy the spectacular view of the coastline. They had set sail on their small luxury boat at around 8 in the evening. As it was the New Year, both friends were having the time of their lives. Although Father Patrick Horgan was a priest at the St. George Catholic Church in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, United States, he had been friends with Dan Burrick for a long time. On the other hand, that week was pretty busy for my dad and his team as they had to deal with reckless sailors and stranded swimmers. He always said that the busiest time of the year for Coast Guards in Miami were the weeks leading up to Christmas and then the New Year. As booze flows endlessly on the coast, people start doing questionable things. On the night of the 22nd of December, he and his team had their hands full with a group of young men who were selling drugs on the beaches. While it was a handful dealing with them around 9 p.m., they received a distress call from a boat. Their captain was an expert at dealing with all these things as he had been a Coast Guard for over a decade. But when he answered this call, he, along with the whole team, were concerned. Very, very concerned. The call was from a cruiser named Witchcraft, and the captain as well as the owner of the ship had made the distress call. His name was Dan Burrick, and he told the captain that his boat had hit something and due to that, the propeller of the boat had become useless. They were stranded near buoy number 7, which was less than a mile away from the shore. That meant they were comparatively close. Immediately, a rescue team was dispatched to the location. It was estimated that the rescue team would reach buoy number 7 in around 15 to 19 minutes, and my dad and his team did reach the location before time. But to their utter surprise, neither the Witchcraft nor the two men were there at the spot. Naturally, it was night and the ocean was dark at night, and the rescue team started looking for the boat and its passengers. My dad was leading a group of Coast Guards, but he always mentioned the night as an ominous night. He said that at night there was something in the atmosphere that he could not see or point out, but only feel in his gut. Not just him, but his entire team was feeling something was off, nor could they find the two men. A couple of hours passed, and there was no sign of Dan Burrick or the priest, and that's when the team knew something was terribly wrong. The currents, which were calm some time ago, had suddenly turned rough, and it felt as if the sea was pulling them into it. The captain decided to call off the rescue mission and they headed back to the shore. Once they were on the shore, they informed the higher authorities and the search operation was expanded to 1,200 square miles that night. And each member involved in the search operation said that they felt something in the air and the water that night. One thing that was in the back of everyone's mind but now was talking about was the fact that the area they were searching in was in the Bermuda Triangle. Witchcraft was swallowed by the Bermuda Triangle. My dad always told me, "Son, do whatever you want, but do not play with the forces of nature. You never know what might happen." And in this story too, it feels like they were against forces of nature they could not compete with. The next day, deep divers and aerial searches were conducted too. Nothing was found tracing back the unsinkable boat and the two men sailing on it. Dad always wondered what might have happened in those 15 minutes between the distress call and the rescue team reaching there. The boat had multiple safety rafts on the boat and Dan did not even fire a flare gun. They just disappeared into thin air. Almost the whole coast of Florida was searched for these two men, but nothing was ever found. I remember my father returning home distressed and heartbroken. He had saved so many lives before this incident and even after that, but I had never seen him so hopeless before. Finally, after a week of intense and exhausting search missions, the case was closed, and Witchcraft was forever remembered as the ship that went in smoke. No parts of the ship were ever found, not on any nearby shores, floating in the sea, or the seabed. It was as if the ship was never there in the first place. Many people tried to find the truth behind this case, but nothing was ever proven. But I have a couple of theories of my own, as someone who had seen the happenings of this case up close. And over the years, my father and I too have discussed endless possibilities. I think there is something in the Bermuda Triangle that is yet to be discovered by modern-day science, and that could have been the reason for the disappearance of this boat and many others. However, that's only one of my theories. I also think that it could be extraterrestrial abduction, teleportation, or even some connection to the parallel universe. I also think that the Bermuda Triangle is a gateway to something beyond our imagination. If you guys have any thoughts on this topic or have any insights on the boat witchcraft, do let me know. Also, what do you think would have happened that night?
For the past 3 months, the news about the Facebook killer is all over the internet. It even caught the attention of some international media outlets. And this case is going overboard pretty fast. Last February, there was a new Facebook account that was opened in Georgia. At first, it was just like any normal account of someone called FBK. However, soon the user started to post pictures of corpses of people whom he had killed. The user tagged all the friends and family of the victim, and that is how we came to know about the Facebook killer. As a detective, I jumped straight into the case from day one. When the first complaint was filed in this very police station, I was given the responsibility to handle the case. But from that day till now, the Facebook killer has killed 7 people and posted about each murder on his Facebook account. And we, as police, could not do anything. This happened during the early days of Facebook, when it had just started to gain popularity. So the digital forensic department was struggling to track the location of this killer. One evening, I was just sitting at my desk at the police station doing some paperwork. Most of the station was empty, as most cops had left for home. Back then, I was around 33 years old and single. So when a stunning woman walked into the police station and sat in the chair opposite my desk, I was a bit awestruck. She had beautiful blonde hair, dark brown eyes, and a beautiful figure. But the thing I noticed a little too late was the fact that she was crying. "How may I help you, ma'am? What happened? Why are you crying?" I asked her. My natural protective instincts kicked in.
"You need to arrest me. Now,"
the girl said while tears rolled down her eyes. "Ma'am, can you please tell me what happened? Why should I arrest you?"
"Because I can't stop. I can't control myself."
She still continued to cry her eyes out. "Can't control doing what?" This was getting more and more confusing with every passing minute.
"I killed my mother, our driver, and the gardener. And you need to put me behind bars. I can't stop. I feel a strong urge to kill. Please, help me, detective."
She begged me and sobbed at my desk. However, I was struggling to believe what this was. Why would someone turn themselves in after committing a murder? Let alone beg a detective to put them in jail. Maybe this woman was mentally unstable and needed help. "Ma'am, you say you murdered 3 people. Can you please tell me where their bodies are, so we can confirm their death and proceed to arrest you?" She seemed to understand that.
"Yes, they are at my home."
Now, if she was mentally ill, she may be bluffing about the deaths. So we had to see the dead bodies to find out if she was lying or was a mentally ill person. "Well, can you take me to your home, where you've kept the dead bodies?" I asked her as patiently and carefully as I could. Being a detective had taught me enough on how to handle such matters. She sobbed for a while and then said,
"Sure, detective."
I knew it would be wise to take a few cops with me in case there were truly dead bodies out there. So I asked Steve and Marcus to accompany me to the woman's place. A couple of minutes later, we stopped in front of a big mansion on the outskirts of town. "Is this your house?" I asked the woman beside me. She still hadn't stopped crying. It was getting a bit annoying at this point.
"Yes, this is my house."
The 4 of us got out and walked into the property. "Where are the bodies, ma'am?" I asked her.
"I have buried the gardener and the driver in the backyard,"
she said, and started walking towards what I assumed was the backyard. Steve, Marcus, and I followed her. We stopped in front of two huge pits, approximately 6 feet in length and 4 feet in breadth. The pits were covered with mud, but anyone could easily tell that these weren't ordinary patches of mud. These were unmarked graves.
The bodies are down there,
she confirmed. And where is the body of your mother? The woman started crying louder when I mentioned her mom. Maybe she truly killed her mother and now regrets her action. Anyway, I had to find the body and call for backup.
Please, come with me, detective. I will show you where her body is.
After you. I followed the woman two floors up into the mansion when she suddenly stopped and pointed a trembling finger toward a room at the end of the hallway. I walked cautiously towards the room and opened the door. It was a well-decorated room, but dimly lit, so I couldn't spot a dead body in there. I walked into the room and still couldn't find the dead body. That's when I saw another door in one corner. It must have been the bathroom, and that's where the dead body must be. I entered the bathroom, and before I could comprehend what was going on, there was a knife in my back. It all happened so fast that I didn't pay enough attention to what was going on outside of the room. The knife was stuck at an odd angle. My hands couldn't reach it. All I could hear was her high-pitched laughter.
Got you, detective. I got you before you could get me.
She was laughing and laughing. No trace of a single tear from before. All I could do was manage to somehow get out of the bathroom into the main room.
I heard that you were looking for the Facebook killer. You were investigating my case, weren't you? But the poor detective had no luck. I bet you didn't expect the killer to be a woman. There is no gardener or driver out there, you know. Neither is there a body in the bathroom. I just wanted you alone, so I could finally kill the detective himself who was sniffing at my trail like an obedient dog. But turns out you're not so good at your job after all.
She was rambling on and on about how she had me and how she was smarter than me, while I lie there on the floor face first. I was bleeding out, and I knew I would die if I didn't do anything. I knew my men down there wouldn't hear me scream or cry for help, and the backup team wouldn't make it here soon enough. I knew I was going to die, so I decided to ask her one question that had plagued my mind since I took up this case. Why did you kill all those people? And why are you killing me now?
Oh, detective, don't you get it? It's just for fun. It's amazing to see the life drain out of my victims. You know it's so fun to see you die, right now.
She giggled even more and just sat there in a chair, staring at me, dying. That's when, with my dying breath, I pressed the panic button on my cell phone, and seconds later, I blacked out. A few weeks later, I woke up in a hospital. I don't know how I was saved or who saved me. All I knew is that the Facebook killer was caught, and I was alive to tell the story of how I almost died on duty at the hands of a serial killer.